skip to the end.
Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Skip to the End podcast. Thanks a lot for coming back if you've listened to the first episode, or thanks a lot for joining us if you're a new listener. I'm Ben. Alongside me we have...
Mark.
And Adam.
And we're going to be taking you through news, reviews, features, etc., same as we did last time round. We're going to be looking at the new Sin City film. We're also going to be having a discussion about sequels that are better than the originals. We're going to look at our homework that we set last week for films that we hadn't seen, our sort of pop culture black spots. Mark's also going to be filling us in on his trip to the Secret Cinema event to see Back to the Future. And we're also going to look at our challenge that we set last week, which was to find the craziest sort of monster mashup disaster film we could find for a pound. I believe we've also had some questions come in through the Twitter and the Facebook, so we're going to respond to those. And we'll set ourselves for a challenge for next week. So, are we ready, guys?
Ready when you are.
Ready.
Let's go.
Right, so we've been to see the film Sin City, A Dame to Kill For this week. So this is the review that we're going to kind of offer on that now. For those of you who haven't seen Sin City or Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, it's a film about the lives of several citizens throughout Basin City, their run-ins with characters both good and evil. We're going to talk about this film quite in depth now. So if you haven't seen it, maybe you want to skip to the end. So guys, I mean, personally... wasn't a fan.
Yeah, I second that.
I'm on the fence. There's bits about it I like, there's bits about it I don't like.
I see your point. It had kind of everything about the first one I enjoyed, apart from the story.
Right.
It's film noir, yeah. Which I love that aspect of Sin City. I love the way it was edited, the way it was put together. I thought it was fantastic. There are certain characters in there I love. I mean, I love Marv. I think everyone loves Mickey Rourke as Marv. One of his probably his better roles. There are other characters who aren't as necessary for me. I mean, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, do like the guy as an actor, but didn't really see a point to his character in the film.
Yeah.
But then that's the thing I want to kind of get across. I liked him in this film. I thought it was refreshing to see someone completely new. The film, unlike, obviously followed the first one, having the same characters again, relied heavily on Nancy, relied heavily on Marv again, but it was nice to have that kind of new character introduced, and I thought he did well. He was up there. He's pretty much most of the film at some point.
I'm kind of going to stop you a bit there, because I think this film was a lot more heavily on Marv than the past one. I mean, if you look at the first Sin City, Marv has his own little section, and then you don't really see him again. Whereas this one seems to think that people did like Mickey Rourke as Marv, so they seem to want to throw him into every story.
But he was always the secondary character in each story. He was always the guy who helped out the main guy in each story. He didn't seem to have his own justification for being there.
Yeah.
He was always backing up Josh Brolin's character or backing up Jessica Alba. Mm. I don't think he had any agency of his own.
What we're talking about is this was the second fiddle, the supporting character to Dwight McCarthy in his story or Nancy in her story.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character, Johnny, he didn't really have that. He was more of a standalone. I kind of see what Mark's saying there. Although I didn't see a point to the character, I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt carried it quite well.
Yeah, he did well with what he was given. I just don't think he was given much. My real issue with the film, the reason why I didn't like it, is because it was, to me, style over substance.
Oh, yeah.
There was no real story there. And it seemed to drag on forever. And then it just kind of ended. There was no real ending. There was nothing definitive. It just kind of ended. And the problem for me was, because it relied so heavily on the style, that was fine 9 years ago when the first one came out, because the style was something new.
Yeah.
Trying to replicate Frank Miller's comic panels on screen.
Which was fantastic.
Which was fantastic, because it was new, it was fresh, it was original. Miller himself then went and copied it when he recreated The Spirit. Do you remember The Spirit?
Unfortunately, I do, yeah.
That was a terrible film. And by that time already, it was sort of old hat. So now, 9 years on, when they've done the sequel... using the exact
same
visual
imagery. They're just kind of hoping people have forgotten about it by now.
So that thing, that real unique selling point that it had, isn't unique anymore. Mm. And it was there for the sake of being there, and it wasn't enough to cover up the flaws in plotting, in that there was no plot, there was no story. It was just a bunch of loosely interconnected vignettes that were entertaining enough to some degree, but there was no cohesive whole. It just didn't come together to form a film for me.
I feel for me, it was an attempt at trying to make a film more about the evil characters of Sin City, but the evil characters aren't that strong as characters. Like Senator Rourke and Ava Lord, in the comic books, they're fantastic in their own little pieces, but they're not really there to create an entire film on, and that's what it felt like to me.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed Powers Booth as Rourke. I thought he was probably the best thing in it for me.
It's the character itself, though. It's not the person playing
him. Yeah, you're right.
He gives me the chills. I was sitting there thinking, that's the type of guy you don't want to ever meet in a bar or get on the wrong side of. He's literally ruthless. He made me feel this guy's pure evil. I think you've summed it up perfectly, to be honest, Ben, saying it's the style of substance, because you can easily come out of the cinema thinking, that was brilliant, and then take a step back and breathe for a second. You know, actually, visually, it was. It was beautiful at times.
It's
slightly
like The Matrix 2 in that respect, where it looks fantastic when you first see it.
There are bits that I certainly enjoyed. You know, there's a specific moment where Jamie Chung's character, samurai sword wielding maniac, jumps out of a window and beheads four blokes in one spin move. As much as anyone, I'm going to enjoy that. I'm going to get a thrill out of that. But well, that does not a good film make.
That's what Miho is there for as a character. And that's what she does.
Yeah.
If you read any of the graphic novels, and even in the first Sin City film, it's the same situation. Miho is just there. Again, similar to Marv in a way, she's the backup of the story. But she's deadly.
So I can appreciate those individual characters, those individual character moments. Just didn't come together as a cohesive whole. It wasn't a film to me.
And it was just a collection of clips. Very anticlimactic, wasn't it?
Yeah, it just ended out of nowhere.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, when it panned out and it had that logo, is this it? Is it not quite over? And then obviously the credits came on, I was like, oh, okay, it is over, but...
Then you kind of think for maybe there's a post-credits scene or something, but it didn't appear like one was coming.
Well, we certainly didn't stop around to wait for one. We got the hell out of there.
So, well, if there was one right at the end of the credits, we didn't see it. Maybe it ties the entire film together.
I think I got to the point where you're getting a bit sick of just knowing it's a green screen throughout nearly an hour and a half. Was it 2 hours, that film, nearly?
Around about,
And I think you do just... I know, obviously, Star Wars like that, and there's loads of films that rely on it heavily, but you know that film didn't actually have proper actors outside the studio, and you knew that. And don't get me wrong, it's great seeing these car chases and these amazing kind of really well-directed scenes. It makes you believe this is a graphic novel coming to life, but I got sick of it after half an hour, and I just wanted to see a real person or a tree or something. I know it sounds ridiculous, but I just...
You wanted Groot.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I was missing Groot in that film, but I think it overdoes it, and for a half an hour little TV series, that would have been brilliant. And that's what maybe you've nailed it by saying it's a loads of series of kind of short clips. Maybe it'd be better as a TV series.
Yeah, I think you're right. If that would have been sort of an HBO series, half an hour each week... You know, one week you've got the story of Dwight, next week you've got Johnny's story. I'd probably enjoy it, but it's not a film.
Doesn't work.
I mean, I'm gonna be a bit of a nerd here, a bit of a geek about this, and really kind of
makes a change.
Pick this one underlying flaw that really got to me. It was during Nancy's story at the end, where this is large spoilers now. She kind of cuts up her face a bit. She cuts her hair off and changes her appearance and character completely. And then she decides to go after Senator Rourke. Now, Marv goes with her, but in Sin City 1, Marv drops off Goldie's sister at Nancy's apartment for her to look after while he goes after the priest, Rourke. And then he kills him, then he gets arrested and gets put to death. So how was Marv around, again, after being put to death later on in Nancy's story?
I don't know. I was really troubled by the chronology of it, because I couldn't work out... One of the things that's not explained is why all of a sudden it's Josh Brolin rather than Clive Owen. And I thought, at one point, well, maybe it's a prequel, because I'd seen in some of the clips that there was a point where Brolin's character has got his face in bandage. So I thought, you know, he gets bandaged up and then eventually becomes Clive Owen.
In the novel, A Dame to Kill For comes before The Big Fat Kill.
Okay, so that would make sense in that part of the chronology. But then how is Hartigan dead? Because if that comes after, then Hartigan, Bruce Willis's character, should have been killed. She would still be alive.
It's a completely kind of...
Whereas he's dead in this film, so the chronology seems off.
It's separate, but, I mean, if you look at Sin City as the novels themselves, I mean... That Yellow Bastard is a completely different novel to any of Dwight's stories.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, in the comics, certain characters overlap. Like, Marv does appear to back up Dwight in A Dame to Kill For. However, later on down the line, Dwight's changed his face completely. But in this film, they just appeared to put Josh Brolin in a wig.
Yeah.
It was the same face. I mean, there's one point where Dennis Haysbert's character actually even says... I can see in your eyes. It's like, well, I'm sure you can see his eyes. His whole face is the same.
Yeah.
He's just got a wig on.
I think they put a slightly bit of a bulbous nose on, but it didn't really hide his face.
Whereas in the novel, he kind of changes his face completely. He doesn't look like himself anymore.
I think in reshuffling those parts around then to fit this film, because as you say, they're separate stories, to rejig them for the film, they've sort of buggered up their own chronology and left these gaping holes.
Yeah.
Which we're just expected to overlook.
It severely annoys me a bit, if I'm honest with you.
As a reader of the books.
Yeah.
Is there talk of a third one coming out now, or...?
I wouldn't have thought so, not after how this one's bombed at the box office. I think it's done 6 million at the US this weekend, which is atrocious. Really, really poor.
I think they projected it to do quite well, didn't they? And it's just not...
It was word of mouth. You know, if you look at the review sites like Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes, it's around the 40% mark. It's been savaged by the critics.
And it is a shame, because I did so thoroughly enjoy the first Sin City movie. Yeah. But I just wonder whether that was a stronger cast.
And I felt that Bruce Willis was shoehorned in this time, where he was integral in the first one. I mean, he was great in the first one, but they've sort of shoehorned him in just because his name is known. He's probably the most famous member of the cast.
And I think we did this with Guardians, so why don't we do it with this as well? Let's break down some of the characters and maybe talk about them.
Okay.
So Dwight McCarthy, played by Josh Brolin, how did you guys feel?
I liked him. I thought he was really good. He was, to me, to all intents and purposes, a completely different character to the one that Clive Owen played. It was supposedly the same character, but the performance was different.
Yeah.
I preferred Brolin, to be honest, because I just prefer him as an actor to Clive
Owen. I think Josh Brolin's a very good actor. I think he did handle the mantle of Dwight McCarthy well.
Yeah.
I think maybe the story itself has kind of screwed it up a bit in that respect.
Eva Green.
Let's talk Eva Green.
Do you mean Eva Green's breasts? That's all I saw. She appeared to be naked for three quarters of the film's running
time. Most of the film, yes. So, Eva Green as Ava Lord.
Yeah, I mean, she's supposed to be this sort of ultimate femme fatale, but I didn't buy it, really.
I just thought it was a bit of a caricature of a character completely. It was just... I mean, there was moments where she was literally just crying for crying's sake, and then she was naked for naked's sake.
Yeah.
And then she was like being this green-eyed, red-lipped, just monstrosity. Really. They just seemed like they tried to mash up every cliche of a female character in a film noir story together in one.
Yeah. With boobs out through the whole lot.
With the breasts out.
My issue with Eva Green, and this goes beyond this film, is that she's French. That's not my entire issue. Let me finish. It's that whatever character she plays in a film, no matter where they're supposed to be from, she always has a French inflection to her speech. So whether she's supposed to be an American, English, there's always a bit of French in there. It's the same thing with Penelope Cruz, how no matter what nationality she's supposed to be playing, she's always got a Spanish accent. And it's something I always struggle to get over. So I'm too busy listening to Eva Green's accent than I am enjoying her performance. If you can hear a bit of rattling there, that is Adam swigging a gin and tonic, which we are currently drinking.
So, yeah, I liked her boobs. No, she was not a great character. I don't think any of us really rated her. They didn't really give a chance to act.
No.
And they relied heavily on her breasts. And it sounds ridiculous, but it's true.
What did you think to Dennis Haysbert replacing Michael Clarke Duncan as Manute?
I liked it.
Yeah.
I thought Dennis Haysbert's a good actor. I mean, I've watched him in 24 before as well. And, you know, I thought he was fantastic as President Palmer. And I do like him as an actor. And he does have the imposing figure you need to play Manute. He is that kind of character. Again, it's not that strong a character from the script point of view. There's a lot of being played and, you know, not really doing much. I mean, he's punching on Josh Brolin for a while. He comes up against Marv and he doesn't really get a chance.
Yeah, they built him up as this unstoppable force. You know, you can't kill him, you can't hurt him. And then Marv whoops his ass in about 10 seconds.
Exactly, I mean...
And rips his eye out.
Well, it's just completely ludicrous, really, isn't it? Okay, let's talk about Mickey Rourke then as Marv. He was a big hit from the first film.
Yeah, again, I like the performance. I like Mickey Rourke. I couldn't tell whether that was prosthetics or just his real face. But I thought he was fine. But as I say, I don't think he had any agency of his own. I think he was just a secondary character in other people's plot lines. So it was great having him around. He's a great character.
He is a great character. And I think they've obviously listened to people from the first film who have said, oh, we liked Marv, let's have more of Marv. And they've just gone, okay, we'll throw Marv into everything.
Yeah.
Because I did like Mickey Rourke as Marv. I remember reading at the time the first Sin City came out, Mickey Rourke went into audition. And apparently Frank Miller said, we don't need to see anyone else, that guy is Marv.
Mm.
So maybe it isn't prosthetics.
Yeah, reduce the cost of makeup.
But no, I like Mickey Rourke as Marv. I think Marv's a cool character to have around, and Mickey plays him very well.
He does, yeah.
So Jessica Alba as Nancy, I fall in love with her more and more in every film. I do believe she's a really good actress, and a lot of people will use her in the way of, oh, she just looks good, she's got a great body, we'll just get her to dance. But in this, I started to believe her a little bit more. I saw the vengeance she wanted towards the end. I was buying into it a bit more than the usual, oh, it's just a fit girl, we'll get her in it just to sell. I don't know, I started to buy into her.
Yeah, I think she did the role well. I think she acted very, very professionally, very brilliantly. But the problem is, they just kind of seem to cram that story in, like either side of other stories. It's like, here's a bit more of that, here's a bit more of that. And then it was, oh, look, now she's cut her face up, cut her hair, dyed it, now she's a completely new person. I believed her transformation. I just thought it was very weak because we didn't see much of it.
I don't know. I didn't like it. I don't rate her as an actress at all, and I don't think she did a particularly good job.
We should probably point out that Ben has watched both Fantastic Four films recently.
I did. They were on this weekend. I watched them. Wish I hadn't.
So he's got a bit of a vendetta against anyone who was in those films right now.
She did to me, which is a cardinal sin when acting. It's when people have to act drunk, and they just do that stereotypical stumbling, falling into a wall, looking a bit surly. There was no grit there. There was no reality to it. It was comic book drunkenness.
To be fair, she bought a kebab at 4 a.m. and threw up in her shoe.
Yeah. Got someone to slag and pull their hair out. That's what should have happened. I don't buy her at all, and I didn't like her having the final say in the film. I just didn't think it worked. I think she's the weak link in the cast.
I was annoyed that Lady Gaga was in the film.
Oh, good God. That was really when I knew I hated the film, I think.
That was like, do you like this film? Now I'm just reading back, actually thinking, yeah, I'm getting off the fence now and starting to lean towards you guys. I just didn't want her in it. It annoys me. She's not...
I think celebrity cameos in that respect kind of annoy me in general.
Yeah.
Unless it's a bit tongue-in-cheek. Like, I think there's in Life of Brian, there's a bit where George Harrison turns up. And it's a bit funny, you know.
Yeah.
So... I like that, but with general celebrity cameos, it does start to annoy me.
Yeah, the thing is as well, they telegraph the cameo, because when Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character goes into that diner, the focus on the character is from behind. You see this waitress from behind for a good few seconds, and you just know, okay, this person's going to turn around, it's going to be someone famous, and you're either going to be delighted or annoyed, and I was on the annoyed side of that equation.
Can we just point out that Adam did just compare... Lady Gaga to George Harrison. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, you know, great musicians and all that.
Worryingly, I think Lady Gaga's probably sold more records now.
That's terribly worrying.
She's dead to me.
Oh dear. Well, shall we bring this one to a close then, lads? Shall
another
we give
podcast,
it the old,
another person Mark wants dead.
Yeah, that's another set of lawyers on the phone. Let's bring this one to a close on that bombshell. So what do we think out of 10? Let's get to the end. Out of 10, Mark, what do you reckon?
I'm going to go straight down the middle, 5 out of 10.
I agree with you. I'm going to sit right on the fence, 5.
I'm going with a 3.
Now, I am not good at maths, so I don't know what the average of that is.
It'll be average of some 3 point something, but let's
now,
just go with...
Now, the reason I'm going with a 3 is because I actually had high hopes for the film, and it's disappointed me a lot. Mm-hmm.
So if we score this in the middle of 4, we're giving that the same rating as, was it Sharknado 2? So well done.
Yeah, so if you want a quote for the DVD cover, it's as good as Sharknado 2. Skip to the end.
So following on from last week, we set ourselves a bit of a task again for this week, a talking point, where sequels are better than the originals. We've all done a bit of research in the last few days, and we're going to basically have a discussion on films we really do feel are better than the first. So I'm going to start.
Go on then.
I've come up with Toy Story 2.
Yeah.
I had a long thought about this over the weekend, didn't go with some obvious choices, and I just thought that was one film that... Toy Story for me was one of the best Pixar films, original story, really entertaining, everyone went crazy for it. Were they going to match it? They've done Cars 2 recently, no one cares. Planes 2, did anyone even see the first? Toy Story 2, brilliant story, better characters, what a twist.
Is it the second one that has... Stinky Pete the Prospector?
Yes.
Then I agree.
All it needs is Stinky Pete.
I'm going to disagree wholeheartedly.
Oh, my word.
I think that's an awful choice to lead off with, I really do.
Did you not like the I Am Your Father?
It was just a bit tacky as a reference.
Oh, dear.
We are going to be recruiting for a new podcaster from now on. If you agree that the second film is better, please contact us.
I just didn't think that even the I Am Your Father bit, like, it's so done now.
What, because Star Wars did it?
Yeah.
No, but I know what you mean, that it's been used as a cultural
people
touchstone
parody,
for so many times.
Parody to hell, and I thought Toy Story 1 was fantastic. I do not think Toy Story 2 was better. Toy Story 3?
Well,
we're getting into a different debate here, but I agree. I think they've got... better each time. I think the third is better than the second is better than the first.
Going to disagree there.
Ben then, agrees with me, two against one.
But I'm a bit, right. A bit of a sticker on this, because I did a bit of research over the weekend, and I couldn't actually come up with that many films that I did believe were better than the original.
Really?
Okay, so we can get this covered off quickly. Toy Story 2 is better, because me and Ben agree. You're outnumbered.
That's called democracy.
Disagree.
Okay, so beat it then, Adam. What have you got?
Well, I'm going to go with the only ones I could think of, Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly, and we covered Empire in a bit of detail.
I mean, the
last
bit
week.
Where he says, I am your father, I mean,
taken from Toy Story. Yeah, we don't need to talk about Star Wars for again and again. No, we're going to be talking about that every week, but I agree.
Yeah, I think we all agree on that one.
Empire was kind of it's the obvious one.
Yeah, it was a big step up in quality from the first. And the first one, A New Hope, as it was later retitled, was a great film in and of itself. But Empire was such a huge leap in quality.
It truly was. I think we spoke about Empire quite a bit on the last
one. We did. So we'll leave that there.
Go on, Ben. What are yours?
Terminator 2. Come on now. Tell me on.
I agree, but I've got so many friends that will be screaming at this podcast that argue with me that it needed Terminator to make Terminator 2, obviously, but Terminator is a standalone better movie, but Terminator 2 for me was incredible. Yeah. I absolutely love it.
T-1000.
Yeah.
Running after the car when his arms turned
to hooks. That first time it actually melted down. Remember the special effects? People were talking about that for years. That wasn't even in the realms of, have you seen 3D on Avatar? This was have you seen Terminator 2, what they do?
They look terrible now. They look like N64 graphics, but at the time they were mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And one of the things I loved about it was how it twisted the original Terminator character. Schwarzenegger's character in the first film was the bad guy, and then in the sequel, he was the good guy who was trying to protect John Connors. I thought it was a great switcheroo. I thought the introduction of T-1000, I think Robert Patrick is unreal in that film.
One thing I liked about the whole Robert Patrick being cast is that he actually resembled Kyle Reese slightly.
Right, yeah.
So when he was there, it did do that, he played across the roles. So when Arnie turned up as the Terminator, you thought he was the bad guy because there was a guy who looked a bit like Kyle Reese.
Yeah.
So you did kind of see it from that side. Now, for me personally, I don't rate either of them above the other.
Okay.
I think they're both kind of on a level.
My heart stopped there now. I honestly thought you were going to say, I don't rate even as good as the third. And I would have kicked you out the window.
No, I think they're both absolutely fantastic films, and I couldn't put one above the other.
Okay. I love Edward Furlong in the second film, and when I was a kid I always wanted to be him. He is such a badass. He's wicked. Love him. I always remember him being a lot older. I think, obviously, because you watch it as a kid, you always imagine him to be 18 or 20. Yeah. He's only about 10, isn't he?
Yeah.
And Arnie in that film's brilliant.
Again, brilliant.
Sarah Connor, unreal.
So we've said, good choice. Two have agreed and one is sort of on the fence. You couldn't rate one Terminator 2.
No, I couldn't. I think it'd be one of those situations where if I watched Terminator 2 now, I'd be like, oh yeah, that is better. But then if I went back and watched Terminator again, I'd be like, oh no, I'm not sure actually. And I think it'd be one of those situations. So I'm not going to make a definitive statement and say it's better.
Well, at least no one said no, so I'm happy. I'm happy with my pick.
I found a film at the weekend when I was researching, and for me it might be up there, and this could be, I suppose, a talking point in the future. It's my favourite opening scene to a film. So, X-Men 2.
Okay, yeah, which I watched last week.
You know when he goes to take over and attack the president?
Yeah.
That opening scene is...
Nightcrawler.
Oh yeah, fantastic.
It's flawless. It's still amazing to watch now. And I just believe the film's better. I think I've watched it many times. I watched the first one and I will always go back to the second film. I don't keep going back to watch X-Men again. I haven't even seen all the most recent ones. But it's X-Men 2.
X-2... when Bryan Singer then stepped away from the franchise.
He did, and Brett Ratner, who is a hack, came to the third one.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about the third
one. X2 is fantastic. It's a great film.
My only issue with X2 was the way it ended. I thought, Jean Grey is supposed to be this all-powerful being, or, have these amazing telekinetic powers and whatnot, and then she gets crushed by some water. It just seemed sort of like, you could get out of that, love. You can fix that.
Yeah.
You've dealt with worse.
The point isn't, is it a good film?
Is it better than
X-Men?
Yes, it is. It's
going to rely on... This is the whole base of my argument for my next film.
Okay.
Which is Fantastic Four: Rise of the Silver Surfer.
Yeah.
God, it's like... Yeah. It's better than the original, but both are awful.
Correct. And as you said earlier, I did watch both this weekend, and they are both crap. But the second one is better. But I think the only reason why I like the second one more is because Silver Surfer's in it.
That's fair.
He's cool.
He is very cool.
He's a cool badass. Yeah. Jessica was terrible in that. I don't mind admitting that.
She was the next big thing.
I liked her in Sin City today, but that film, she's dreadful. What's going on with her hair as well? It's weird.
It's too blonde. For a girl with her skin tone, the hair is too blonde and it just looks absurd.
I know. Should we talk about skin tone and what colours would go well with hair for that? I think she should definitely be dyeing that a darker shade.
Right, lads, here's one for you. One that's going to surprise you, seeing as you know my feelings on these films. Better than the original, Spider-Man 2.
I wholeheartedly agree. I love Dr. Ock.
Yeah.
One of the... Probably, actually, out of all the Spider-Man films, even the new ones, he's my favourite baddie.
Yeah, that's been in. At the time, as you know, I don't particularly like those three Spider-Man films or the two more recent ones. I'm not really a huge fan of the character. But I really enjoyed Spider-Man 2. And I thought that up to that point, Doc Ock was the best version of a comic book villain that had been put on film. It's since been surpassed by Heath Ledger's Joker and Loki and possibly others. But at that point, I thought this is the best comic book villain I've seen.
No, I loved
Doc Ock.
There's nothing cheesy about him. You know, with Sandman, he didn't quite... Obviously, the CGI I thought was terrible in that, so he didn't look right.
Well, everything about Spider-Man 3 was terrible.
Venom, I don't even want to get involved. Even the new one, I didn't like Daniel Dehan as the Green Goblin. I didn't buy into him. He just looked cheap. He looked like a performing arts student that got his own makeup and tried to become a baddie, and it just didn't sell it to me.
I've kind of made a point about Amazing Spider-Man 2 to my friends recently, where if they'd marketed it as Spider-Man versus Electro, and not said that Rhino and Green Goblin were going to be in it, I think people would have been a lot happier with it, with these guys just turning up and it being a big surprise to everyone. The fact that these guys were marketed as big villains within the film, and then every villain's only in it for, a total of about 10 minutes each.
Yeah, you see Rhino at the start and at the end, and that's it.
Yeah, it's just a bit ridiculous. Just
setting up future films, isn't it?
Yeah, but
Amazing Spider-Man 2 is definitely not a sequel that's better than the original, but Spider-Man 2, we're all agreeing on this one.
I'll give you Spider-Man 2.
Is that the first one we've all agreed on, or do we agree on one of the other? We all agreed on Empire, didn't we?
And X-Men.
Sure, we all agreed on Rise of the Silver Surfer as well.
And Toy Story 2.
No.
Yes, come on, Alan.
Well, I'm going to bring up, from that, The Dark Knight. You mentioned Heath Ledger's Joker, better than Batman Begins.
Yeah, I would agree entirely.
I do love Batman Begins. It's a beautiful, amazing film that really took me by surprise. I thought, not Batman again. I think the last taste of Batman I had in my mouth was
Batman and Robin.
Do you know what I mean? There's nothing worse. Oh, my Lord.
Freeze.
But ice to meet you. Oh, my God. But you can't... Dark Knight, you know, there's nothing to be more.
Like, are you trying to make an argument and Ben's just sitting there making Mr. Freeze puns now?
It's good. Keep them coming. Going off on the old superhero, quite recent, Captain America 2.
Now, it's weird that. If you would have asked me that, if you would have put that to me the day we went to see it, we all went together. As you know, I didn't particularly love it. But I've thought about it. It's one that was a thinker for me, and I've thought about it quite a lot in the intervening period. I've decided now I liked it more than I thought I did. But that said, I still don't know that it's better than the first one, because I really enjoyed the Red Skull as a villain. Mm. So I would put them on a par. I think objectively, once I've seen the second one again, I probably will like it more than the first. But I'd need to see it again to make a judgment. At the minute, I'd put them on a par.
I'd probably do the same there, same as Terminator there. I love them both so much that I don't think I could rank one above the other. I actually watched Cap 2 again yesterday.
Yeah.
Because I bought it on Blu-ray. And absolutely loved it again, but I know how much I loved Captain America when it first came out as well.
That's what I did. I bought it at the weekend. I watched it again. And it's more of a thriller. It's just a really... Don't get me wrong. I don't think the baddie's as good as the first. But I just believed in all the characters more. And it is a really, really good film. I think, Ben, if you watch it again soon...
I will do.
You can come back to this and say, yeah, I agree.
So I think we're just going to call that one a no.
We'll call it a tie or something.
Yeah.
Okay, here's one for you then. Godfather 2.
No.
No!
I'm happy to go on to this now and admit this. I've not seen all the Godfather films.
Oh! Homework!
Now,
That's 9 hours of homework.
I've seen the first one.
Maybe the first six.
I've got a pact with my best mate who's said that we're going to have a bottle of whiskey, we're going to sit in my cinema room and watch all three back to back.
Yeah.
We're going to do it on a day. He's never seen the other two either, and it's kind of if I went and watched them about him, he would never speak to me ever again.
Well,
so,
you better tell him he's got a fortnight to do it.
He's up this weekend.
Excellent.
So we're going to do it.
Awesome.
There you
awesome.
Go. That's amazing. My homework.
Perfect. Okay. So you're going to watch all three?
Yeah.
I'm not
chuffed.
I feel I said no too hastily to there, Ben.
Okay.
I love The Godfather 2, but yeah. Again, I also love The Godfather 1 so much yeah. that I couldn't... I mean, for me, Godfather 2, De Niro, is the best thing about it,
sure.
for me.
No spoilers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. I will just say that the thing that puts it over 1... For me, I love 1 as well. I absolutely adore it. I love them both. The thing that puts it over 1 is the dual narratives, the dual sort of timelines yeah. that run... That's what really sells it. But I'm not going to say any more because of Mark's okay. telephone.
We'll put that one on hold then until Mark's seen them.
We'll talk about that in more detail on the next podcast.
The next film I've got down, and this is my last one on the list, hopefully someone will come from this, but I've got Blade 2.
Crikey. I've seen the Blade films, but I can't remember which ones.
So refresh your memory, do you remember the third one is dreadful? What is it with the third films? Matrix, that, Spider-Man... The second film is, you might remember the nightclub scene.
No.
Oh, yes, yes.
And that's phenomenal.
It's been so long since I watched the three Blade films.
Me too.
But I do actually remember that scene, because I remember being about 14 when I watched it.
It's not really worth talking about then, but it might, trust me, it's a better film. Come on, Ben, throw one out there.
I'll take your word for it. To be honest, I think I've reached my limit of the ones I could think of at this point. The only other one I've thought of, which links in quite nicely to something else we're going to talk about, is Back to the Future 2. I happen to think that Back to the Future 2 is a better film, it's a more compelling film, but you may disagree on the basis that you've recently been to the secret cinema event for the first Back to the Future film.
Yep, I'm happy to talk about that. For me, the first film, God, that's really hard to choose. The third one is definitely not anywhere near as good as the first two, but it's still a good one. But it's still a good film, yeah. It's still alright, it's a nice end to a trilogy. Like The Dark Knight Rises, not a great film. But it's an alright end. I'm still never going
to
agree
that. It did. I mean, Back to the Future 3 did kind of round off the trilogy in a nice way.
Yeah. I just, you know...
The second one is brilliant.
A time train. That's one step too far for me, man.
I think with Back to the Future 1 and
everything
2...
Everything up until that point was fine.
It was all golden. It seemed legit. You know, putting bananas into a flux capacitor or whatever all seemed fine.
It depends on how I'm feeling. Some days I prefer the second one, some days I prefer the first. At the moment, from last weekend, nothing is going to beat the first one, in my opinion. The second one, I'm on the fence, I'm not sure. Probably the first.
For me, personally, I agree with you. I think the second film, to me, I favour it to the first, purely for the fact that there's so many little references to the first film in the second film. Like, it's that kind of dual narrative again, I guess, that you spoke about with The Godfather 2, where you can see Marty in the background on stage playing the guitar while he's like sneaking through the dance, and he's actually above him at one point himself, and I think that's fantastic, I really do.
And two words, hoverboards.
Yeah.
So,
one day.
Done.
One I've just thought about, which is a massive one that I can't believe we've missed, Police Academy 2. surely that's one of the best films you've all seen.
Do you know, I was thinking the other day that I might... I don't know if this is a punishment or not, but I was thinking about watching all of the Police Academy films in a row. All seven. Or is the seventh one Mission to Moscow?
Yeah.
I was thinking about watching them all in a row. I quickly stopped thinking about that.
Why did you do that? It's like saying I might just watch all the Carry On films.
It's because they're making a sequel, and I heard a new one, like a reboot. And I heard they were making a reboot, so I looked on IMDb to see how many there'd been, and there were seven. And I thought, you know, if it's a really slow day, maybe I'll do that.
How about Short Circuit 2?
I actually love Short Circuit 2.
Short Circuit 2 is great.
But I don't recall that or the first one well enough to determine which was better. I've not seen either of them in 20 odd years.
Mark gets The Godfather, you get Short Circuit 1 and 2.
No, thank you.
So, that's our sequels better than the originals event for this week.
And I know there's probably going to be loads of people now writing into us saying, I can't believe you missed this film off. Well, yeah, we talked about The Naked Gun 2.5, and although it was funny, it's not as funny as The Naked Gun.
So I was lucky enough last week to attend the Back to the Future by Secret Cinema in London. They had the Olympic Village and they turned the whole site into Hill Valley. It was literally the whole site. To summarise, Secret Cinema spend a massive budget every year trying to bring a film to life. They'll find a destination, have loads of staff working for them and do everything they can to make this film seem reality. So in a snapshot, they turned the whole village into Hill Valley. You had the school, you had the town fair, you had all the shops, you could go and attend the sea dance.
That's awesome.
Yeah, you could do absolutely everything.
And didn't they project the film itself onto the front of the... Is it like the town hall that's meant to be with the clock?
Oh, yeah, it's the actual clock tower itself.
Really? That's amazing.
Yeah. So imagine when you go to a music festival like Reading and Leeds and stuff, you have that massive stage.
Well, the festivals are available.
Yeah, V and all those other ones. That's the size of the stage. They then painted it all to make it look like the clock tower. Yeah, and you're right, they projected exactly on the centre of it.
That's amazing.
That sounds really cool.
They turned the whole of the seating area, so everyone sat on this kind of astroturf, but it was the square in Hill Valley, so you could put blankets down and sit there throughout the day. Now, what made it so special? I never knew what to expect. Unfortunately, Secret Cinema cancelled the first two performances. They didn't have rights, I don't think, with the local council to do some of the things.
Okay.
It really tarnished...
There were some quite big stunts and whatnot.
Yeah, they really tarnished their own name, and it was a shame because I was even considering not bothering going anymore because I heard about people...
It was in the national news, I remember it.
It was a real shame.
But was the experience very worthwhile in the end?
It was phenomenal. For the marketing up to the event was one of the things that really kind of got my attention. You signed up, bought your ticket, and they sent you an ID. So I was Bill Beisley, who was a clerk who worked in Hill Valley. So I was sent a business card and my name badge, and it's up to you how much you participate. You can just delete that and turn up in your jeans and hoodie, but I was meant to dress up like a clerk. So I had a shirt, a tie,
had
braces like the 50s. Basically, I tried to dress up like an idiot that would go and see Bombay Bicycle Club. That indie, stupid approach look, and I fitted in really well.
Bombay Bicycle Club.
Who isn't? Turned up looking in my 50s gear. The best thing about it was, I think 4,000 people went the night I went. Everybody dressed up in 50s gear.
Oh, that's
so you had all these women in dresses, like prom gowns. You had all the guys dressed up as either clerks, students, and it really made the whole experience seem real.
You'd feel like a right idiot if you're the only person who didn't turn up in full 50s dress, wouldn't you? If that's the case. But so everyone's in 50s.
Yeah, even the staff. So all the staff that were showing you, it was more like a festival. That's what it was like. So you turned up, as you walked into the main entrance, they had one of the farms there. So there was animals, real like sheep and goats and all this. There's a guy playing on a guitar, singing around like a little campfire as you walk in. Everyone, even the people taking your tickets, all speaking in an American accent, all again dressed up. You went into the main kind of auditorium, and the whole of the town was built around the viewing area, and you had shops where you could go and get your nails done, you could get your hair done. There was another little cinema within there showing like a 50s film with all old vintage seats.
Wow.
They had McFly's house you could go into. It had his car on the drive. It had the same kind of post box with his name on, the garden. When you went into his actual house, they'd built... It was only like a kind of marquee, but they made all the outside look exactly like the film. It had a TV, chairs, you could just feel like you were visiting his house. What made it the most believable is while you were going around and getting your food and drink and stuff, you could go and order food from places that were actually in the film. So you could go to Lou's Cafe.
He orders the Pepsi free.
Yeah.
And the guy says, listen, buddy, if you want a Pepsi, you're going to pay for it.
Brilliant. They were selling shakes in there. There's 50s music. Oh. All the currency was all, again, in dollars.
Did you ask for a Pepsi free?
No, I didn't. Yeah, even the guy that was doing the cleaning in there looked like the guy from the film. And every now and then he'd stop and be looking around. And you thought, what's he doing? And I was sitting there. And then the guy dressed as McFly would run through. So you felt it was exactly like the film.
Oh, amazing.
There was a fairground there to go on the actual fair rides. You could go into the prom. They had a band playing in there, so you could go and have a dance if you wanted. They had all the school lockers, people had left cards. The amount of detail they'd gone to was insane. But what made it most believable for me was the cars driving around. So you'd be sitting there or just going to go and get a drink, and there was a kind of an old like sort of Cadillac. I don't know if I'm not into my cars, but it was like the one in the film. And there's a guy dressed just like Biff driving around with guys in the back with baseball bats looking around like they're like after McFly, beeping at you as you're walking around. Once the film started, so this is all before kind of getting you into the gear, you'd all
so
sit down.
What time did you kind of get in?
I got in at 6, around 6, half 6. The film started at 8:30, so you had 2 hours to go in.
And how long was it open from then?
From about 6, so you had like...
So it opened at 6.
Yeah, I was in there straight away.
2.5 hours, kind of get a vibe of actual 1955 Hill Valley.
It's such an immersive thing then, isn't it?
It's
all well and good just erecting a stage that looks a bit like Hill Valley, but this is a lot more than that. It's really immersive.
It's an actual town that it's actually great.
It's insane. I'll put some pictures on the... Now the event's over, I'll put some pictures on our Twitter and Facebook to kind of give an idea of what to expect. But it's... While you're watching the film, this is where I thought, is I just going to do all this build-up and then you watch the film and that's it? The film starts... And then suddenly, remember the scene where the DeLorean is first brought into the movie, and there's the kind of thing like the garage opens or the doors open and it comes out? This was on the actual stage. As you're watching the film, this smoke started to come out from underneath the screen, and I was like, what's going on? Doors opened from underneath the stage, and the actual DeLorean from the movie drove out, and I was like, this is unbelievable. Pulls up, and then it kind of is reenacting where the film is in front of you, which is a good thing. Some people would argue and say it takes away from the film, but it made it feel like you were there. So a guy dressed as Doc is getting out, and word for word, he's miming to the film, perfect timing. McFly comes along, they're sitting there having the exact conversation that's on the film. Do you remember then when the camper van pulls up and they've got...
Libyans.
Yeah, the Libyans, and they've got the guns. Again, this van pulls up.
Wow.
People dressed up, guns, reenacting the whole film. This doesn't happen the whole way through the film, the main key parts of the film. When the car goes up to doing 88 miles per hour and then suddenly goes back in time, it goes round all the crowd, all 4,000 of you, around the back of you. Because you're all sitting safely, it can go along the roads that, you know, there's no public ground. It's all being shut off while the film's on. It's going fast. It suddenly hits towards this clock tower. Fireworks go off. And then what really happens is the car just turns left so you can't see it, but it looks like the car's just disappeared. The whole crowd are up, clapping, like, wow, this is amazing. It felt like I was there. I wish everyone could have experienced it.
I imagine it's like, just the whole thing in general sounds like something you have to experience. It's not enough just to be told about it.
I'll be really intrigued to see what they do next.
The only other bits I want to talk about was the bit where Biff gets punched by McFly.
Oh, yeah.
He pulls Biff out of the car. Who's trying it on his girl. He punches him in the face. The whole crowd jumped up, literally cheering. It was just one of those moments that was just phenomenal. 4,000 people cheering on this guy to punch him, because everyone knew what was coming on.
Yeah.
And the very final scene where you may have seen that they're trying to get them back to the present day. Doc's on top trying to fix the clock.
On the
actual clock tower. He's doing that in front of you. So there's this massive stage and he's on the top. There's a zip line going across. So as he's falling, trying to save the day and put the cable, he goes along the whole 4,000 people crowd, gets this cable, puts it together just like the film to try and make it so there's enough electricity to generate. He's actually doing that in front of you. You've seen this guy dressed as Doc, white hair flowing in this amazing outfit hanging above you, looking above. Incredible.
So this to me sounds like one of the things that might have caused the hold-up or the cancellation.
Yeah, that's probably
those sort of stunts.
Yeah.
Or the car thing that you described.
Yeah.
It was going to be one of those things, surely, that the council weren't sure about because of health and safety. And, you know.
No, it was an amazing experience. I've got nothing but good things to say about Secrets Cinema. This is on the bit of an on-the-moment thing. If you could have any film where you could have a Secret Cinema do that for you...
Oh, dear.
And you're not allowed to say Showgirls. What would you have as your film that you could live in...
It needs to be something where there's a lot of stimuli, you know.
It's hard, isn't it, to think? Because I was thinking, what else can they do? And I know they did Shawshank, which was obviously a really good film, but I don't know how you could go into that much detail for Shawshank.
I'd probably say The Dark Knight.
That could be quite cool.
I think I'd love to see, you know, especially the car chase scene, you know, the end of that where he pulls himself out of the truck and he shoots the floor and he's just going towards Batman, who's unconscious on the ground.
I bet you'd love to see the bit where the motorbike is up the wall and flips. I think that's your favourite bit.
It's hard to think, isn't it, what film you could have that would work as well. Like,
imagine something like The Matrix, if they could somehow do that. You'd have to be in something like, they'd have to book out like an observatory or something that has walls that have TV screens on that you could put Matrix-y weird shit on.
I think I'd have Sharknado.
I reckon you could actually get Tara Reid to turn up. For
yeah,
not
sure.
But no, the Dark Knight for me, I think it'd be fun. I mean, imagine them doing a sort of live bank heist.
Just people in the crowd with the masks on.
Yeah, exactly. I think that'd be incredible.
There you go. I'll tell you what, if that happens this time next year, royalties.
Definitely,
get the old Skip to the End lawyers on them.
So perhaps a Skip to the End rating for Back to the Future Secret Cinema?
9 out of 10.
Awesome.
Yeah, the only thing I'd recommend they do next time is even though they have to keep it in character, just send an email saying, bring a coat if it's cold, because, you know what I mean? You're outside at 10 o'clock at night.
You lost your star.
And most people should have common sense, but that's, it's...
Yeah, you're adults, you should know to do that anyway.
You lost a star because of that secret.
The rumour is that they're doing Ghostbusters in the UK next year.
Cool. Oh, did they not do it in the UK before?
No, and there's big talk that they kind of going to... They hire out like a building they can turn into a library so you feel like you're in the film or something. I've seen what they did in the American one, and they actually had a cinema. You're sitting watching the film and they had a Stay Puft, and I'm talking it is huge, inflatable, attacking the crowd, and awesome. It looked amazing. People came out acting as the Ghostbusters with lasers, and it was kind of Slimer was going around as like a projection. So that's the sort of thing I could imagine, but you're never going to get a film on the scale of Back to the Future, I don't think, that you can have that much detail, because there's just nothing's going to work on that scale.
I think it seems to me like they've done it pretty correctly, if it's the way you've said it was.
Yeah.
I mean, to have the DeLorean actually there and chasing around, going off to 88 miles an hour. I know you said it was, you know, just turning left, but with all the fireworks, I bet it kind of did feel like
it was amazing.
It was actually happening, you know. Awesome. So, I skipped the end rating of 9.
We just wanted to take a quick minute to say a word on a couple of Hollywood icons who've passed away recently. First of all, we're just going to have a quick mention of Robin Williams, who sadly took his own life a week or so ago. But we don't want to get too morbid about this. We just want to remember the good things. So, guys, what are your thoughts and memories of Robin Williams? What was your favourite Robin Williams performance?
Standout performance would be Good Will Hunting.
I think that's the same for everyone. I think the standout Robin Williams performance is Good Will Hunting. Dr. Sean Maguire, I think, some the name of the character, and he's absolutely incredible.
It's not my standout performance because I've not seen that.
You've not seen Good Will
Hunting? Oh,
so not that I want to step on this loving tribute to talk about homework, but I think that should probably be my homework.
No, definitely. I completely agree with you on that. I think that's a film you need to see.
And I shall, in his honour. My standout performance of his is in 1 Hour Photo.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant.
He is as creepy as hell in that film. And obviously, prior to that film, he'd already proven that he was as good a dramatic actor as a comedic one. But that was the first time I watched him and thought, he's not just a stand-up comedian or a comic actor. This is the real deal. Mm. I love him in that film.
I mean, I'm a bit annoyed about the whole bandwagon of tribute to Robin Williams in a way. Because everyone's going on about him now like he's the best thing ever. I love him. I think he's brilliant. But I loved him before he died. It sounds really bad to say, but everyone is now talking about how great he was as an actor, and then you turn around and say, like, no offence to yourself, Ben, and say, oh, he's brilliant in Good Will Hunting, never seen it.
Yeah.
Now at least you've seen 1 Hour Photo.
Yeah.
I assume you've seen Dead Poets Society. Yeah. That's my favourite film that he did. Dead Poets Society is fantastic. But there's so many people that have only seen him as the genie in Aladdin.
Yeah, or Jumanji.
I just find it a bit ludicrous.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with people saying, it's a shame the guy's gone, he did good work, but I've only seen Jumanji and Aladdin. But it's when people pretend that they know his extensive background, when they've only seen Mrs. Doubtfire.
Exactly, and he was a fantastic actor. And I think we have spoken about it before, how brilliant he was as a serious actor as well as a comedic one.
Indeed.
Good Morning Vietnam.
Yeah.
A great film.
I think that's brilliant for the fact that how it shifts from comedic to serious.
Yeah,
he obviously starts out as quite a larger than life character, and obviously after the spoilers, but the bombing at the bar, it goes very, very sour and serious, doesn't it?
And that sort of sums him up. What he was so good at, strafing that line between comedy and tragedy,
and little known things like his appearances on Whose Line Is It Anyway, as well, which I've seen him on, and he was fantastic on that.
Really,
as a great improv comedian as well,
and he's in Friends.
He is. He's in an episode with Billy Crystal.
Yeah. My earliest memory was when I was a kid. Might show the age difference here now with Adam, but Mork and Mindy.
Yeah, good show.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, always used to make me laugh. I think it's his voice, I think, I find the most entertaining thing about him. If you think about his voice, I know he's all seen Aladdin and stuff, but just think about the way he talks, his impressions and his accent for Mrs. Doubtfire and everything. It's just such a great voice. You know it's him straight away whenever he's interviewed, and I don't want to get bleak here. I just think it's such a shame of that age and to be married with kids and to still choose that he wasn't happy, that he had to take his own life, is just tragedy.
Exactly.
Bicentennial Man?
I haven't seen
that. I've not seen that.
No.
Again, it's a very good performance from him as well.
Really?
So it's not a great film for the plot line or anything, but he is very good in it.
Yeah.
And the final one I want to mention, Insomnia. People forget about that film.
Yeah.
Christopher Nolan, you know?
It's probably my least favourite Nolan film, but I do think Williams is very good in it.
And another member of Hollywood royalty that passed away this week was Richard Attenborough. He died at the age of 90. He left behind a legacy of work that stretched back, I think, probably to about the 50s or 40s. People of our generation know him best, I would say, for Jurassic Park, which was a seminal film in all of our lives,
Definitely. Yeah, as discussed last week, it's in my top five films of all time. A great, great actor in that film, really believable.
I mean, for myself, I remember him on the films of my child, which is Miracle on 34th Street.
Oh, yeah, where he played Chris Kringle.
Always remember him for that.
Yeah, he was great in that. We need to remember as well that he was a director.
Yeah.
He won a couple of Oscars for directing Gandhi, won the Best Director Oscar and Best Picture. So, you know, he could act, he could direct, he could do it all. And Hollywood and British film are at a disadvantage now that he's gone.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
This week we launched our Facebook page, which is www.facebook.com/skiptotheendpodcast, as well as our Twitter page, which is @STTEpodcast. Thanks very much to Sarah Hansworth, who's put in a question for us all. Now, these guys haven't been asked this question, and it's completely live, so good luck. What is your favourite movie of 2013?
Ooh, that's a good question.
So thank you, Sarah, and if anyone else wants to ask any questions, please feel free.
Well, you say yours, you've actually seen the question.
You can have some time to think about it.
Have some time to think.
For me, definitely my favourite film of last year was Her. It wasn't that really established. It wasn't all over the news. It was kind of a bit of a secret that people knew about until it came. Did it get Oscar?
It got Best Original Screenplay.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, Spike Jonze.
And it was actually nominated for Best Film, I think, as well.
It was an absolute travesty that Joaquin Phoenix wasn't nominated for Best Actor because he is. He gave the best performance of 2013 for me in that film and wasn't nominated.
Yeah, so a very big thought-provoking film for me. Spike Jonze, a really good director, but what I really liked about it is the fact that it just basically was him that carried the whole film. You never got bored of him, like you just said. His acting, Phoenix, in that film was perfection.
Yeah.
A really clever idea for a film that was one of those films that I remember watching it and was thinking about that film for about 2 weeks. And I think, Ben, I would have spoken to you about 10 times after watching that film saying, I'm still thinking about it. There's bits about it that really... You question everything. It was
you that actually recommended it to me, I remember. And I remember sitting there analysing it kind of after I'd watched it, realising how brilliant it was. I mean, just... It was quite horrific in a way. I mean, it opens up with this man who's separated from his wife, who's writing love letters and love cards for other happy couples. It's just, I mean, what a horrifically morbid job that'd be if you've just been separated from your wife or something like that. But then to find this operating system that you fall in love with.
Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, if it's Scarlett Johansson talking to you, it'd be very easy to fall in love with.
Yeah, and a shout-out to her for that, because even though she was this disembodied voice, she felt like a flesh-and-blood character, and that was all on her. She carried that.
One thing about that film was the cinematography, and I believe that you could pause that film anywhere in that film, print the screen, and it would look good as a poster. It is beautiful. Yeah. The shots that have been done in that film are beautiful, and... Yeah, it's just a really, really thought-provoking film that, for me, was miles above anything else. If you haven't seen it, I recommend, we haven't really done any spoilers here, go and see it, because it's phenomenal.
Yeah, it really is.
Definitely.
Well, you've actually beaten me to mine. I would have said Her as well, so I'll go to my number two then. My number two was American Hustle, which I thought was just a great piece of work. I'm a big fan of David O. Russell anyway, but this particular film, to me, was David O. Russell channeling Martin Scorsese. It was a spiritual sequel to Goodfellas to me. The vibe of it felt really, really similar, you know, right down to a cameo of Robert De Niro as a gangster.
Probably quite good then, because I've not actually seen American Hustle.
Wow.
Amazing to compare it to Goodfellas, which was obviously my homework for this week.
Excellent.
So I'll lead off with American Hustle for next time then.
We won't talk too much about the storyline,
the cast is brilliant, and... David O. Russell has this ability to get the best out of his actors, which is proven every year whenever he releases a big film, be it American Hustle, be it Silver Linings Playbook. He manages to lead all of his actors to Oscar nominations. You know, he on average gets sort of 3 or 4 Oscar nominations out of his actors each time. He just gets these astounding performances out of people who we know are good, but sometimes you think, I didn't know they were that good.
Yeah.
Like Jennifer Lawrence just blows me away every time. I know how great she is now, but I still, my jaw still drops in certain performances. Like I rewatched Silver Linings Playbook a couple of weeks ago, and she is so good in that, just untouchably great.
I really find it hard to say anything good about her after hearing that she's now with the singer of Coldplay.
That's only a rumour, though. I hope
if there was
Christ,
any truth in that, she's dead to me.
Yeah, me too.
But until that moment, her CV was getting better and better.
My number one's actually her as well. But for the interest of, well, having an interesting podcast, I guess, let's not all talk about the same films.
Yeah.
And I'll go with Dallas Buyers Club.
Okay, yeah.
I think McConaughey, absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
Obviously led off that with then True Detective, the TV series. Another incredible performance from him. But I think the kind of who stole the show in Dallas Buyers Club was Jared Leto.
Yeah, he did.
See, I'm not a fan of Jared Leto. He used to wind me up for being associated with 30 Seconds to Mars.
Yeah.
And I don't really like that band. I don't. All he ever does is just yell. And
yeah. Well, he's a 40-year-old man dressed up as a 20-year-old man singing to 12-year-old girls. There's something not right there.
Lost Profits.
Well, you said it, not me.
But yeah, he in that film was up there with Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah,
incredible. I mean,
my previous favourite performance of his was in Fight Club, purely because he got his face smashed in.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, I keep watching that now and then. But
he is brilliant in Dallas Buyers Club,
yeah.
As is McConaughey. And as I said earlier, I think Joaquin Phoenix should have been nominated for Best Actor and should have won it. He gave the best performance. But as he wasn't nominated, I think McConaughey was a fully deserving winner.
Oh,
of Best
yeah,
Actor.
definitely. And Jared Leto, fully deserving Best Supporting
Actor. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Nailed it. Well, thanks again for the question, and any more would be welcome.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping.
Okay, so listeners of the last podcast will realise that we set ourselves homework for this week. Now, for those who are coming in and listening to this one without listening to the first one, Ben kind of brought up a point about pop culture black spots, which are films that everyone seems to have seen but yourself. So we all set each other homework when it came up on the cast. Mine was Goodfellas. Ben?
Mine was to see Leon.
Mark?
It was The Graduate.
The Graduate. So what I'll do is I'll kick off with mine then and what I thought. I watched Goodfellas and I thought it was fantastic.
Excellent.
Really did. I thought Ray Liotta was fantastic.
Yeah.
De Niro was brilliant. Joe Pesci, absolutely unbelievable. I can't believe I've never seen this film before.
Neither could I.
It was one of those films where I sat there and I was literally hooked for about 2 hours, 20 minutes, I think.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't take my eyes off it. I mean, everything from start to finish was brilliant. I love it jumping back in times when Henry Hill was a kid.
Yeah.
And it just sort of goes up through him growing up through the neighbourhood, gets his first job at kind of the shop on the corner, and eventually becomes, you know, an aspiring gangster.
Yeah.
It's just one of those classic tales for me. I thought it was absolutely fantastic.
It's brilliant. I'm delighted that you finally got to see it. Now, in your top five last week, you mentioned The Departed. So where would you rank this as a Scorsese film against
I prefer it to The Departed.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Big statement.
That is, I mean, as do I, because it was in
your
top five. But for it to jump that high into your list, that's amazing.
It's already there. And I kind of think with time, for a lot of the time with me, it's like, how long afterwards do I still feel that way?
Sure.
But I do think this one's going to be one that lasts. It's going to be up there for a while. I think it may even eventually make my own top five. I enjoyed it that much.
Oh, you're getting an argument from me. I absolutely love it unreservedly.
So it must be amazing to now have this brought into your life.
Yeah.
It's one of the biggest films of all time. I can't believe you'd never seen it. And now to go, here you go, wow.
It's literally one of those things where I finished watching it and went, that was amazing. I don't think the homework I set anyone else was as good.
Well, I can follow on from that if you want.
Yeah.
I got round to watching The Graduate for the first ever time. I really enjoyed it. It was very different because I've been watching so many most recent films. I haven't been watching anything from that era. It reminds me of the kind of Breakfast at Tiffany's era.
Yeah.
So it's obviously set around the same time, but the pace of the film is quite slow and really... It was a really quirky, weird kind of setup. And I felt it was this one kind of film where you're really getting to know the character and you saw that he was... Falling in love with this Mrs. Robinson, and then the kind of film changed completely when he got more involved with the daughter.
With Elaine, yeah.
And then it was a completely different film. It felt like it was completely changed. Then it turned again and it changed again. But
it's amazing how the soundtrack shifts with that, though.
Yeah.
Obviously, it starts with The Sound of Silence. Mm-hmm. It's a very slow-paced, slow-moving soundtrack for a slow-moving film.
Yeah.
And then towards the end, when the film kind of kicks itself into high gear, the song Mrs. Robinson, which is a more upbeat, fast-tempoed song, kind of hits it.
Yeah. It was. I watched it as well, because I hadn't seen it, so even though it wasn't officially my homework, I watched it. And I really enjoyed it, and something you've just said there, Mark, is exactly what I felt. It felt, in a way, like a film of two halves.
Yeah.
The first half was like the sort of slower build, the seduction and affair with Mrs. Robinson, and then the second half was him realising that he actually loved Elaine and chasing her. And as much as I enjoyed the film overall, I preferred the first half. Because I didn't realise, actually, that it was a comedy drama. I just thought it was an out-and-out drama. So I was surprised at how funny it was, how often I found myself laughing. Like, there's a scene in the first half of the film where he goes into the family swimming pool wearing scuba gear that I was just in bits. I thought it was hilarious, and I just didn't expect this from this film. But then the second half of the film, when it goes to him chasing Elaine, he just became creepy to me. He just seemed a bit stalkerish.
Yeah.
It's not as if he was just like, I'm going to run off to uni to see if she wants to be my girlfriend. It was, I'm going to run off to her uni so she'll marry me. And it's like, stalk much? It was a tad much for me the second half. But overall, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I think my only gripe, and it's not really a gripe, and I'm sure thousands of people have said this, is that Dustin Hoffman was 30 at the time. He was supposed to be playing a 21-year-old. There's no makeup in the land that's going to make that fly. But I did enjoy it.
What did you think of his performance?
Oh, it was great. He's sort of naive, scared, nebbishy performance was really good. And I was reading something today that apparently one of the people they initially read for the part was Robert Redford. And Mike Nichols said to him after his audition something along the lines of, you're not right for this part, you don't have that underdog spirit that we need. And Robert Redford apparently said, I don't know what you mean. So Mike Nichols said, well, have you ever been turned down by a girl? And Robert Redford was like, what do you mean? He was like, yeah, exactly. So that was his reasoning for not having Robert Redford and wanting someone like Dustin Hoffman, who was a more believable underdog.
No, that's brilliant. I'm glad you guys enjoyed
that. Yeah, I did.
With the actual comment there about Mike Nichols, I thought, as a director, I've not seen lots of his films, but I felt he is way ahead of his time. Some of the shots he did, you know, when like you were saying, then he's in the water, and there's a bit when you could see the shots from underneath the pool, and I think there's a scene where he had a helmet on or a hat or something. I remember something that was really intense, his breathing. Some of the shots he was doing seemed way, way ahead of his time. He was a really well-directed...
Yeah, the composition of some of the shots is really odd. One of the very first shots is of Dustin Hoffman's character's... Benjamin Braddock, his dad, talking to him. And his dad was Mr. Feeney from Boy Meets World, by the way. Let's
nice.
Just throw that out there. But his dad was talking to him. And the dad was in the foreground, and Dustin Hoffman was in the background. But Dustin Hoffman was in focus. So his dad's head was out of focus.
Yeah.
And his dad's head was half covering Dustin Hoffman. So at first glance, you're thinking, that's a really poorly composed shot. But then you realise, no, this was clearly on purpose.
Yeah.
And I really liked it. And there's probably some sort of thematic reasons for it, but I'm not smart enough to know what they are. But I just really enjoyed the composition of that shot.
There was Mrs. Robinson being quite seductive, and she had her leg up.
Yeah.
And there was a shot, you could just see what she was saying underneath her leg. So it was quite seductive up there, looking quite sexual. But the shot was beautiful. Like, all you could see was just her face underneath her own leg. And it was like, I sat there thinking, this is so good. Like,
you just seemed to capture the moment.
Brilliantly.
It seems very well.
Like nobody else has, and especially back then, you know, I just...
That scene that you talk about, that's the famous scene where underneath her leg you see Dustin Hoffman and he says, Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. And I'd only ever seen that clip, so he seemed so certain when he said it. But the next line is him then going, aren't you? Or something, you know, and then backtracks and realises maybe she's not. And I've never seen that in the clips before, and that just changes what the performance is and what his mindset is.
My only annoyance about it was that I'd seen Wayne's World, who did the whole spoof of the end.
Yeah.
And it kind of ruined it for me, knowing that I'd seen that exact scene and, you know, seeing Mike Myers smacking on the glass instead as that scene. I was like, damn it, but, you know, it doesn't take anything away from that, and I'm really glad that, you know, I watched this and you brought it into my life, because it's a really good film. And
I did enjoy it.
Well, since then, I've listened to the soundtrack.
Thank you both for Goodfellas.
You're welcome.
Now on to you, Ben.
Yeah,
Leon.
Now, you know, I'm just going to echo, Mark, something that you've said to me many, many times. How can I not have seen this film? You know the sort of films I'm into. This is exactly it.
It's
as if it was written for me.
It's basically Ben the movie.
Yeah, it's Ben the movie. It was absolutely brilliant. First of all, you've got Gary Oldman giving one of his classic unhinged performances.
Absolutely incredible.
Gary Oldman's one of the best working actors. He can do everything. His range is phenomenal. But unhinged is the best colour on him. I love unhinged Gary Oldman. And playing a smacked up drug agent or whatever he was fantastic.
It's something that always gets me about Gary Oldman, because there's so much of a campaign about Leonardo DiCaprio never winning an Oscar.
Yeah.
But Gary Oldman is in a similar boat. I mean, the guy has been incredible for, 20 years now?
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think he'd even been nominated until Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Yeah, I mean, unbelievable. I mean, he, like you say, unhinged, Gary Oldman.
Yeah.
He can play that.
You can't beat it. But the thing for me, the best thing about the film, and I expect you guys will probably agree, was Natalie Portman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She is so good in that film. When you think that, I think when it came out, she'd have been 13. So I imagine she'd have been 10, 11 when it was filmed. But she just has the demeanour and the spirit of a much older woman. She doesn't seem like your typical child actor. She doesn't seem like a girl that you would see on some crappy sitcom.
Yeah.
She's a real actor with giving a real performance. And you can understand why there's that love between her and Jean Reno's character, you know, Leon, that does seem a bit icky at times, because at first it seems like it might be a paternal bond, but then it seems that it's more than that. It's never sexual. You know, he never makes it that way, and he specifically says it's never going to be that way because he's an honourable man. But you can see why he would love her, because she is just so lovable, and it's an amazing, amazing performance from Natalie Portman.
Did you, and this is a spoiler part, but did you see the end coming, or...?
What, that he would die?
Yeah, the way he takes himself.
I didn't know the exact, you know, the minutiae of how it would happen, but I expected that he would...
It's a weird feeling, because he dies, but you're really happy for him in the way that he's kind of got what he wanted, and that grenade at the end, and again, sorry if you've not seen it, but wow, the way that ends. And again, I couldn't believe you'd never seen that film, and I don't think there's much more of a film you could say that is made for you.
Yeah, I did absolutely love it. And, you know, Luc Besson has done some good films since. He's done some absolute tripe as well, but I think that, of the films of his that I've seen, that is by far and away the best.
Brilliant. So we've all had some great homework. To summarise, we've got some great homework coming up. So next week, I'll be watching Godfather. I think I'll do all three, so I can refresh myself with the first. Adam, you've got American Hustle. Very good to follow on from Goodfellas. And Ben, Good Will Hunting.
Excellent.
Following on from last week, we set each other a challenge with £1 to go out to any kind of charity shop, car boot sale, and find the best animal-based disaster movie we could find.
And by best, you mean worst.
Yeah. This followed on from us reviewing Sharknado 2. I don't mind starting this one. I found in the hospice shop spiders. the tagline is, "Something's very hungry, about to hatch." So, to give you an idea, the synopsis for this is, at a lab, a scientist injects something into a huge spider. The bug is put into a box with no label on it.
Oh, no.
That's it.
They mislabeled the box. Good God.
That's the most disastrous thing that happens in that movie.
To give you
about badly administrated.
The way they promote this on the front of this really good DVD is, from the special effects team who created From Dusk Till Dawn, Spawn, and Wishmaster. Now, this does have a great cast in it. It has Lana Perilla.
Oh, I know. I actually know who that is. She's brilliant. In Once Upon a Time, that TV show.
There we go. Oliver McCready.
No.
And Josh Green.
No.
The summary for the back of the DVD, which really will make you both want to watch this... A top-secret DNA experiment is a rare breed of spider will go horrifically wrong as a freak shower engulfs a NASA space shuttle whilst in a deep space mission. Something is hungry and is going to hatch.
So,
yes.
It's on a ship?
Yeah.
As in a spaceship?
A spaceship.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow.
So, not only has the box been mislabeled, it's been put onto a spaceship.
This is it. IMDb, give it 3.8.
That's fairly... Oh, that's
if only, you boys can beat that, I'll be very
impressed.
That's
0.02 worse than our Sharknado 2 review.
Indeed.
So can you boys beat the amazing masterpiece of spiders?
I'm not going to tell you the name first, I'm going to give you the plot synopsis. When an oil company has unwittingly unleashed a prehistoric shark from its icy prison, the Jurassic killer maroons a group of art thieves and a group of beautiful young college students on an abandoned piece of land. The two opposing groups are forced to do what they can to survive, or become food for the not-quite-extinct Jurassic Shark.
Incredible.
another little tribute to Richard Attenborough's legacy.
Yeah, brilliant.
I'm pretty sure he wasn't in this one. Jurassic Shark. I really don't think I need to give you any more info than I just have.
Do you think you've won with that? Do you think
Dinosaur from the Deep,
I mean,
you know?
It is atrocious. There's no reason for it to exist, and its rating on IMDb is 1.5.
You're never going to beat that now. That's it.
And well, the one I've got is 2.5, so is there any point in even saying?
Oh, I'd like to know what it is.
Okay, well, I'll launch into a bit of it, because I've actually seen this film. Me and my friends have watched it. it's called El Chupacabra.
Ah.
It was from 2003, and the plot synopsis is, the world seen through the eyes of two people, the inequities of society is exposed and examined in depth in the most surreal manner. So, it seems to be trying to be a bit more than it is as well.
Brilliant.
I mean, basically, it's about the Chupacabra legend.
Yeah, it's like a Mexican beast or something.
Yeah, that sucks the blood out of goats. Now, there is a line in this film which is absolutely incredible, because it is as if they only had the money for one take, and they just thought, oh, she's got the line wrong, but whatever. She literally says to the song, I can't remember the character's name, this is how forgettable this movie can be.
Yeah.
She goes, yes, they're primarily found in regions where there are lots of goats. She's talking about goats. They're having a conversation about goats, and she says, they're most commonly found in regions with lots of goats.
She's not wrong.
She's not. She isn't.
Famous actors or directors?
No,
or?
None at all. Eric Alegria.
Oh, right, Eric.
Elena Madison. Nope, no, me neither. No.
I think she works in Kelly.
Calvi Gabon. Nope, me neither. I mean, it's incredible. There's actually one of the hugest goofs I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
There's a bit where two detectives are looking at a body who's been killed, but he's breathing.
Right.
The actor is literally breathing. Oh. So he's supposed to be dead, but you can see his chest going up and down. There's another fantastic moment where they're driving down sort of the wrong end of the tracks, if you will, and they're talking about people there who are, you know, they're on drugs, and the person goes, well, yeah, you know, I suspect that these people are either on meth or glue. Yeah, because they're about the same. People who have sniffed glue regularly go on to meth next, I'm sure.
It's a gateway drug, glue.
But it's just, it's an awful, awful film. But it's the only saving grace it has is that it's awfully brilliant.
Right.
We need to watch this as a group, okay?
Yeah, let's do this.
It is one of those films where it's so terrible that you actually just have to laugh at it.
So, Ben, did you want to go ahead and set this week's challenge for us?
Yeah, well, we've been speaking a lot today about sequels. Specifically about which sequels are better than the originals. So for this week's challenge, I wanted to go to the opposite end of that spectrum and say, can we go out to car boots, charity shops and whatnot and find the worst straight-to-DVD sequel you can possibly find?
Straight-to-DVD?
Wow. What I'm going to say, let's not call it a £1 challenge this week, because I think we'll be hamstringing ourselves if we do. I think we need a bit more scope. So
straight-to-DVD sequel?
Yeah. Go out and find the worst straight-to-DVD sequel. Challenge on, challenge accepted.
Well, Disney have done some terrible ones.
So Mark's got off of them on Steelbook.
Beverly Hills 2 or 2.
That's going to get mentioned every podcast.
If it doesn't exist.
Well, it should do. Okay, yeah, challenge accepted. Adam?
Yeah, challenge accepted.
So that's it. That's the end of another Skip to the End podcast. That's episode 2 done. Episode 3 will be with you in about a fortnight. On that episode, we're going to be reviewing the new thriller, The Guest, starring Dan Stevens, more famously known for Downton Abbey, but we won't hold that against him. We're also going to be doing our challenge, which is to find the worst straight-to-DVD sequel that we can find. And then we've also got our homework. So my homework is to watch and review Good Will Hunting. Mark?
I've got The Godfather Trilogy.
Excellent. And I've got American Hustle, apparently the perfect follow-on to Goodfellas.
Indeed.
I just want to also pick your brains next week about best cinematic villains.
Okay.
Now, I've kind of spoken on this cast about how I thought Ava Lord and Senator Rourke weren't the strongest villains for Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. So I'd like to kind of get people's thoughts now on who they think are the best cinematic villains, and more importantly, your thoughts on that.
Excellent, yeah, good idea.
In the meantime, we'd like to get some more questions involved from you guys and get you interactive as much as we can. So if you want to visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/skiptotheendpodcast or hit us up on Twitter at STTEpodcast, we're more than welcome to answer any questions or anything you think that would be good to input to any episode.
Also, send us your suggestions for best cinematic villains, who you guys think
are
the sort of pinnacle of cinematic villains.
Indeed. Thanks for listening, guys.
Cheers. Thank you.